Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Someone once asked a Zen master, "What is the greatest miracle in the world?" What is the greatest miracle in the world? And this Zen master answered, "I'm sitting here alone." That's a very simple statement. I'm sitting here alone. This is the greatest miracle. You know, to be alone, to be really alone, you know, is a very great achievement. We usually, probably quite unconsciously, feel a need for other, whatever other may be. Perhaps, we have this need for other because we feel something is lacking within us. Or we feel, you know, it's just that we feel something is lacking. You know, in the old Zen question, you know, what at this moment is lacking? It is in our lives as if we are unconsciously seeking something, and we hope to find it, we look for it in other. It's almost like we look at ourselves and there's a bunch of holes in here somehow, and we stuff these holes with the presence of other. Somehow other makes us feel a little more complete, a little more a part of everything that's going on. Without other, we don't seem to know who we are. You know, we lose our identity. Now, other can be lots of things. Something you're comfortable with, something you're uncomfortable with, something you don't like, something you like, all kinds of things, this other. But this other, when we're conversing together, other is rather like a mirror in which we can see ourselves, and therefore we have an identity. Without other, if there were absolutely no other, we would suddenly be thrown back upon ourselves, and then all of a sudden would come up this question, who am I? You know, and to some this is an uncomfortable question. When we are alone, we seem somehow to be in strange company. We don't know with whom we're with. You know. When we are with other, you know, things are very clear and very defined, you know. We know the name, we see the form, we know cat, we know dog, we know man, we know woman, we can name them. And so, of course, we know them. And, you know, we know man and woman. We know they're Christian or they're Buddhist or whatever. Or they're American or they're German or they're Indian. These are the ways in which we name and define other. Other than ourselves, other than I-self. Now, how do you define yourself? Defining others all the time, how do you define yourself? Well, most of us, we call ourselves Christians somewhat, you know. And I would like to know, or maybe you call yourself Buddhist or you, whatever, Are you using this definition of yourself to keep out the understanding of other ideas? Christians believe in Christ. What is this Christ? What is it? What is this that you believe in? You know, we might be any number of things. We might be a fundamental Christian. We might be a reborn Christian. We might be one who belongs to high church or middle church or low church. And of course, you know if you're a man or a woman. And you know if you're young or if you're old or if you're in the middle. Middle is a long stretch, isn't it? Yeah. What age are you? In the overall scheme of things, how old are you? You know, I've told this little story before. This man came to visit the temple, and he gave each monk a donation according to his age. And one monk asked him finally if he would leave a contribution for Manjushri, you know, the great god of wisdom, one who stands there with the sword, you know, so that you will finally come to learn. And to this question, you know, would he leave a donation for this Manjushri, the visiting donor replied, well, I would gladly, if you will tell me how old he is. Well, how old is wisdom? So, this alone, without other, and we turn within to be alone, you know, and it, we close our eyes and we look inside there and it's dark, and it's undefinable, you know, we don't have a lot of definitions for it outside of dark, and it is almost as if all of a sudden there comes about an emptiness. It's kind of like an abyss. And as you observe it, you suddenly find that maybe you're going to merge with this thing. And there's a fear. So you turn around and you rush out for other. Some thought. Some notion. Some idea. Something other than being alone. Other, regardless of what it is, helps you to remain outside of yourself. When there is no other, there's nothing. No, there's nobody. You're simply left with your emptiness. And for some, it's a fearful situation. And people do a thousand and one things. Even though they think they're seeking, they give it this definition, they give it this label, I am seeking. And all they're doing is hanging on to other. Anything, just so that they're not alone in here. Yeah. We have imitated our neighbors. We have tried to become like them, because if we are like them, we are not alone. We're doing the same thing they are. How can we be alone? And we lose our individuality, and we lose our uniqueness. And we have been doing it ever since we have come into this world. You know, we did it quite unconsciously to begin with, and it is how we develop the personality. Somebody did something that we liked the looks of, and quite unconsciously, we adopted it. Someone said something we liked, and we adopt that. We have imitated our parents. That's where you start. And that's pretty ingrained, because it's the beginning. Everything else is built on that. We imitated our parents. We imitated our teachers. We have imitated our friends. And we don't live this in the past. We are doing it still. Look at the kids, especially the girls, I guess, growing up with all of this television and their imitation of the movie stars and the celebrities. No. And they expect their lives to be happy forever after, because it's what comes about on the movies. And now, well, I don't know, they're dyeing their hair. NBC? how much is that imitation going to be? You know, it seems, in a way, that our lives consist of this little-known subject. It is subjective in here, this little-known subject, which is looking out there for an object. And we take this body, which has its limitations. Yeah, the body has limitations. You can't go that way all by yourself. You can only go that way and this way, but you can't go that way. It's limited, huh? It's like the mind. It has its limitations. And with these limitations, we look for something outside of the limitation. And the moment that we look, you know, it's like a big circle we are, and we're going outside the circle to find this other. The moment that you do that, that you're using this limitation state to go outside, that other becomes an object that you are trying to place within limitations also. So we wind up having a limited looking for a limited. It's the same trip. Now, we've all spent many years looking at this other, the daily existence, our ordinary existence, and with it we have conditioned ourselves. We have a conditioned view of ourselves. We have a limited view of ourselves. We have a conditioned view of other. We have a limited view of other. We have a conditioned view of life itself. We have a limited view of life itself. There is me in here, and there is this other there in this ordinary life, which is either pleasing me or it's hurting me, which it shouldn't do. And we have this tendency to run our whole lives out of that condition, trying to avoid what displeases us and running after objects or situations that we think will give us pleasure. Thusly, we remain separate from our life. That is, we are simply analyzing, you know, and we're judging. And we're trying to figure out in all situations, is it going to give me pleasure or should I avoid it because it's going to give me pain? What am I going to get out of this situation? So we do this from morning until night, and from morning until night, and from morning until night. And maybe sometimes in the night, too. Yeah. We in America are known for our friendliness. We have nice, friendly faces, and we smile a lot. But underneath these nice, friendly faces, these facades, huh? It could be there is a degree of anxiety. It is almost as if we sit on top of a fear, and we have our trips to cover this. So we are either overly nice, overly rude, overly aggressive. We overeat, we overdrink, we oversmoke, and yuppity-yuppity-yup, you know, we overtalk, you know. Something, anything to cover this basic anxiety. One day, when our monk was sitting with a visitor, and they were sitting at a coffee house, and they were watching the people going by, and suddenly the monk turned to the visitor and said, "You see that woman coming across the street? She's trying to do the impossible." And the visitor said, "Well, what do you mean?" You know. And the monk said, "She's wearing shoes that are 2 inches too small." "Hmm?" The monk says, "How do you know?" "Well, she's my wife. And look at her. Look at her face. Such agony. She's trying to do the impossible." "Hmm?" And some people live this way, day after day after day after day. And of course, as the years go by, it gets worse and it gets worse and it gets worse. And the flexibility, you know, the flow and the joy that should be in life goes, you know. So it's time to wake up and to know that we need to work with ourselves a little bit. Huh? What we have to do, basically, is to see through the mirage that there is a me separate from that, from other. When I and other are one, you know, when there's just one, there's not this duality of I and other, then for a second, in this, what they call a samyana, you know, we see what our life is really all about. Now, everyone wants a sane, natural life. Of course, our definitions of sane and natural all vary, but this is basically what everybody wants. And once we begin to get the glimmer, you know, that the problem is not outside of ourselves, it's not that other, and we bring it back here, then one could say we have begun to walk the path. We have begun to turn around. Yeah? Once we begin to turn around, we see that life can be a little different than our tight, rigid, restricted, constricted dualism. And so we enter a discipline, a practice that will allow us to live in a more sane manner. And the discipline is about working better in an office, raising our kids better, having better relationships, getting a handle on ourselves, yeah, having a more satisfying life, a more complete life, which comes out of a sane, balanced practice. Now, when we sit down to do this thing, to practice this discipline, we find, shouldn't take long to find, that the primary thing we have to work with is, oh, my dear foolish mind. See? Our busy, chaotic mind. We are all caught up in this little frantic conditioned state. And the practice of meditation, the discipline of meditation, is to begin to bring that mind into a clarity and in a balance. When the mind becomes clear and it's open and it's balanced, you know, balanced, it's no longer caught in between these two of the dualist state, huh? This subject and object. And no longer being caught, we have the possibility, because this balance is here now, and we're not caught, we have the possibility of seeing who we really are. So one, and I say it so often, observe your thinking. Observe the thoughts. Don't get involved with them. Don't be attached with them, to them. And don't be identified with them. You observe them. And, you know, you look at the thought and, oh, yeah, I'm doing that one again. You know, we do. And so without judging, you come, without any judgment, it's not a good thought, it's not a bad thought, it's just a thought that I'm doing again. So without the judging, we return to now. Not out there where the thought has led us. Yeah? We return to this present moment. And if one will keep dragging oneself back and dragging oneself back, at some point in the practice, the thoughts begin to get dimmer. And they become less important. And you will find that there are periods when they have a tendency to fade out altogether. But there's something in here we also have to face. We don't really want to give up the thoughts. It is our thoughts that we are attached to. It is how we define things. How are we going to define what happens if the thoughts are not there? So we hang on to them. But you can let them fade. If you look, you know, the thoughts are rather like a tape recorder, huh? It's, and so you just let this tape recorder run. Just let it run, you know, and it'll run over here after a while, and it'll just run, and it'll fade out, you know. Besides, you know, after you've seen the same movie 500 times, you know, it does get boring. But unless you're paying attention and observing, you won't know it's the same movie. So the practice, you know, for a long, long time, you know, this constant drawing back to this here now. Here now. Sit. Alone. Oh, but I will be lonely. All alone. Lonely and alone, huh, are two different things. Lonely is a mood. It's an attitude. Alone is a state of consciousness. Now, this discipline to be alone, recognize this state of consciousness, is difficult. And there are a great many people who say, oh, yes, I'm ready. I'm going to sit. Yeah. But give me something, some kind of question, some sentence, some mantra, something to sit with. Please give me something to think about, is what they're saying. If I have something to think about, then I'm not alone. There is the other. You see that? Now, some of our difficulties also are caused by growing pains. This conditioning, which we have gathered through the years, has become a mask. We call it personality, from the Latin persona, which means to sound through. You're sounding through a mask. You, whoever you are, whatever you are. What is going on behind this mask, this persona? Are you still wearing your childhood clothes, your childhood conditioning? Are you still using it as a shield? Outgrown clothes, you know, are a bondage. They confine. And so we have tensions, and we have constrictions, and we have anxieties. You know, it's this nice shield that we hide behind. And so I keep stressing, come ye out from among them. Come ye out from behind the shield, and be ye therefore alone. It almost seems as if we have our existence in the eyes of other. They're watching us, so we know we are, and thusly we behave, and thusly we act, and thusly we do. And there are people who throw themselves away trying to exist in the eyes of other. Other doesn't know who you are. You don't know who other is. But they define you and you define them. It's a mutual trick. It's a game of defining. And in all of that, who defines the soul? What is the soul? Everybody looking for the spirit and nobody looking for the soul. If you want to know what you are, who you are, you have to go where you are. You will have momentarily to forget the world. You have momentarily to forget the other and what they say about you. Good, bad, or indifferent. You know, if some people are, as long as they say something about me, at least I know I'm around. Deep within yourself, where you are, you will encounter reality. Do you remember what you looked like on the first day you were in your mother's womb? Was there a face? Hardly. But you were there. You couldn't be seen with the naked eye, but you were there. Today, somewhere deep within, you are here. We observe people in their behavior patterns, in their actions, you know. We all do this. You do it, and I do it. But, you know, it's kind of like we're watching leaves falling from a tree. And when enough leaves have fallen, we run around and we collect a basket, and in this basket We collect all the leaves, and now we say we know the tree because of all these actions and the behaviors. Huh? Really? You know the tree. What about the tree from which the leaves came? There are times when all the leaves are gone and the tree stands naked. It isn't acting. It isn't behaving. And it stands bare against the sky, like in Rilke's poem. Huh? Then what about that tree? You know, leaves disappear. In the spring, they come again. There's great green foliage. And then the flowers come. And then the fruit comes. What about that tree? You know, in the Upanishads, we read, rooted above with branches below, is this immemorial tree? What kind of a tree is this? You know, with its roots above and its branches below. You should know it. It is you. Listen to your body. It has a wisdom all of its own. It doesn't think. It just has wisdom. If you don't listen to it, you'll be distracted, and you can be disturbed, and there will be, again, some anxiety. You know, our monk, he came home one evening, and it was a Thursday night, and he came home for dinner, and his wife served him baked beans. And he threw the plate of beans against the wall. And he shouted, you know, I hate baked beans. And his wife looks at him, she says, but monk, I don't figure you out at all. Monday night you like baked beans. Tuesday night you like baked beans. Wednesday night you like baked beans. And now Thursday night you say you hate baked beans. You're inconsistent. Yeah? So we sit on Monday night. Great. We sit on Tuesday. Well, it's fine. You sit on Wednesday, well, we're tired. And on Thursday, let's forget it. Yeah. One day, fine. Another day, it's too much. Yeah. But if it suits you, then the repetition, you know, the going on and on and on, you know, it's no problem if it suits you. We go on breathing all the time, same breath. Same breath, same breath. You take a bath over and over and over and over and over and over, and you're always using water. You're repeating. You go on sleeping, and it's the same sleep. It suits you. Suiting you, it's not a repetition. So repetition is an attitude. If you're living in harmony with your nature, then you don't bother that the yesterday has gone. There is just this moment. And the enjoyment of this moment has nothing to do with new things or new excitement or if you're repeating. It's just this moment. With his body, we see, and we hear, and we smell, and we taste, and we touch. How often do we remember that it is the body that is doing this? I'd like to see you taste chocolate without a body, or have a drink of water without a body, or smell the flowers without a body. However, also, in order to see and smell and taste and touch, we need mind. It has to have something to register upon. If the mind is so conditioned in its outgrown clothes, how can we know the experience, the actual experience of touching or smelling or tasting. We are caught in the conditioning. You heard the fly? Did you hear the fly just then? There were two men walking along the street. And they were the street they were on was a very crowded sidewalk in a downtown area. So, you know, there were lots of people. Let's say you were in Times Square in New York, or where else is a busy street? Downtown Berlin, in the Ginza, in Tokyo. Lots of people. Business area, San Francisco. Suddenly, one of these men exclaimed, "Listen to the lovely sound of the cricket." And the other man couldn't hear it. And he said, "You know, how can you hear the sound of a cricket in the midst of all of this din of all of this people and traffic and all that?" You know. So this first man actually was a zoologist, and he was trained to listen to the voice of nature. But he didn't explain this. He simply took a coin out of his pocket and he threw it on the sidewalk, whereupon a dozen people stopped and looked around. And he said, "We hear what we listen for." We hear what we listen for. You know what you're supposed to be training yourself to listen for? Listen to the sound of one's hand. We all know that. That's the sound of two hands clapping. What is the sound of one hand? When a child is growing up, when a child is, you know, from 2 to 4, 1 and a half, 1 to 5, 7, 9, whatever, you know, it's curious. And it has a very natural curiosity about the world in which it finds itself and about himself. And he asks, or she asks, "What is this?" And, you know, they ask that all day long. He didn't learn to talk yet. Why is this? What is that? What is this? Why is that? How did I get here? You know the story, The little kid asked his mother that, and she went all through the whole rigmarole of the whole thing. And finally he says, "You know, that's all very fine, but what was the name of the hospital?" That's all he wanted to know. His neighbor was born in the Methodist hospital, and that's really all he wanted to know. The name of the hospital. You know, how did I get here? I brought you home from the hospital. Fine. Yeah, at 4 years of age. And they ask things, you know, like, why is flower red? Do you know why a rose is red? Oh, yeah, let's not burn down the building. Good for you. You made a wish with each one? Well, he said birthday boys. Do you know how come a rose is red? How do you know how come a rose is that silver lavender? I don't want to know anything about how the genes in the chromosome came together to make that particular color of green. But children are very curious. They want to know. And it seems to me sometimes that as we mature, that we get more and more conditioned, and we lose that curiosity. Why? Maybe it's because we've stuffed so much of the other into the mind, huh? Like a pillow. Yeah? And there's so much in it that we think we already know. Yeah. And so someone comes along with a new idea or a different idea, and immediately we refuse it. We don't even have any curiosity about it. It's just no. Are our identifications so strong that nothing is to be allowed in? I still maintain that we're not going to understand anything by refusing it. So let the new thought in. Let it mill around in all this old conditioning. It might upset an apple cart or two, but so what? No? Better to question than just to settle down and be complacent and to miss it all. No. There is all this beauty and this splendor and this majesty and the dignity of living. Not to be curious about it is somehow the vibrancy of life has gone away. It's dormant or it's asleep. Have a curiosity. But on the spiritual search, just curiosity is not enough. Now, as I understand it, if I understand it correctly, there are three words that are used in the Orient. So curiosity is named there, kudahel, which is a childish curiosity. A childish curiosity has nothing at stake. You just ask why the tree is green. Most any answer will do. Well, it's green because it's green. And it's not long, and the whole thing's forgotten. How many of you remember the questions you asked when you were four? Earth-shaking questions? You know, and even at that time, we had the question, who made all this? How did all this come about? At that time, 2 to 4, you know, it's a floating notion through the mind, you know, Mama cooks dinner, breakfast, and lunch, and I see her doing this, so she creates this, and there's a cake sitting in front of me. So somebody must have made all this, you know. So who made all this? How did they make it? You know? But it's not an earth-shaking question that you need to know the answer to. You know, you don't really have to have an answer. It's just curiosity. Then there comes, however, what is called inquiry or jigyasa. This inquiry, you've gone beyond this childish curiosity. Something is taking root. You've got the same question over and over and over and over so that it becomes a part of your life. You're not asking for asking's sake or to keep the conversation going. You really would like to know, you know. And then there is this third term, which is mumuksha, you know, which perhaps could be translated as kind of a hunger or a very passionate desire. So curiosity, in a way, is an amusement. Inquiry is more scientific. Through inquiry, one becomes a philosopher. Through inquiry, one can become a scientist. But when this inquiry becomes a matter of life and death, when you can't rest, when you can't be at ease with yourself unless you know, then the tiger's got you by the tail. Mumuksha. Yep. Like this little 7-year-old kid who was at a dancing class. And this particular session was involved with being taught the proper way to ask the girl for a dance. Mm-hmm. So he did this, and a half hour later he comes back to the teacher and he says, "Now how do I get rid of her?" Really funny, woke up. So we watch. And what we watch is this dear, foolish mind who has led us down so many paths. And we see how it tends to be superstitious. How the mind tends to be egoistic. How the mind tends to be defensive. Just watch. That's where we start, watching. And this enlightenment, of which there is so much talk, maybe we are viewing it incorrectly. All our lives, in looking for this other, we have been going forward. Don't you feel as if, you know, in your life, you're looking forward to tomorrow, you're going forward. You don't look forward to going back to yesterday. You're looking forward. We're going forward. We go from birth to death, always going forward. The road is down the line that way. Yeah. We're reaching for something. We go forward in this light where we can see. We don't reach back here in the dark where we can't see anything. We're reaching forward. Now, the path to the enlightenment is the dropping of that. You don't reach out there for something. It's going backward. It's a return. And we find also in enlightenment, there is an absence of something. People want to get something, you know, they're reaching for this. And so we say enlightenment is the absence of something. And we have to practice for this absence. And it has to be done by you, for you, so that you know what this absence is. Do you know what this absence is? Out of experience. Out of experience, do you know what this absence is? There's no substitute for you doing it for you. Yeah? We can read different things until we're 1,000 years old. What will it do for the true identity, for the true self or the true nature? Keep trying to feed it other and feed it other and feed it other. It doesn't need it. It doesn't even understand it. We all have to practice. And we usually have to practice with all our might for a long time. And to everyone, there come moments. Moments when you feel, really feel beauty. When you feel love. When you feel this wonder and this awe and this miracle. And in that moment, there is no sense of me. Looking at the stars at night, suddenly something is absent. There's a disappearance. But at the same time, something rises. Something very virgin, something that is uncorrupted, something that is unpolluted by other. And we know it is not other. It is not a substitute for other. It is this purity that is uncorrupted by culture or by civilization. Just this purity. And there is this dark, empty sky. And in this absence of something, you are empty. So there are two empty skies, and all of a sudden they meet. And it becomes one vast sky without a trace. Yeah? I want to thank you. Mm-hmm. You did lots of work over there, and it's very beautiful. It's beautiful. So keep talking. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.